I'd like to first of all, well, to thank the organizers for providing me this an opportunity to speak here, and also for arranging a number of very interesting sessions that I'm looking forward to participating in. So this is joint work with three students, William Slavk
Unger, and Sarvagya
Upadhyay. And the underlying question is, well, it can be looked at in two perspectives. A sort of quantum information or physics perspective is, what happens if we do multiple non-locality tests, like Bell inequality type tests, in parallel? How do we analyze them? Can we just analyze them separately? Or can there be some sort of interaction between the tests that we have to concern ourselves with? I'll explain that shortly. But another sort of angle on this is it concerns an area in computational complexity theory, and much of computational complexity theory involves some sort of notion of certificates for computations, like for NP, non-deterministic polynomial time, you have a certificate for membership in a language that can be verified efficiently, and it's kind of like a proof that that's supplied. It may be difficult to discover, but once you're provided with it, if your system is worth anything, it should be possible to verify its validity. And there have been sort of extensions of this notion of a proof system to scenarios where the prover and the verifier have a more interaction. It's not just that the prover sort of writes down the proof and hands it to the verifier or sends a message, but the prover asks a series of sort of challenge questions, the verifier to the prover, and they may be randomly determined, and if the prover is able to answer them all correctly, then the verifier will be convinced with high probability. And it turns out that having this interaction and randomness increases the expressive power. There are certain languages that have proof systems, efficient proof systems in the interactive random scenario, but they don't have more conventional proof systems where it's just NP, where the proof is written down in advance. And an even more general notion of an interactive proof system is where you have two provers. And the two provers can't communicate with each other, and they just communicate with the verifier. And the verifier, I mean, it's roughly analogous to having two suspects being interrogated. And you put them in separate rooms, and if they're actually trying to somehow, if they're dishonest, well, they just honestly answer the question. But if they're somehow trying to deceive you, convince you that something is true which isn't, then it'll be more difficult for them to coordinate their stories if they don't know what, if one party doesn't know what questions you're asking the other party. And there is actually a sense in which this has even more expressive power, having multiple provers. So let me just review some the basic scenario of non-locality and Bell's theorem. And I'm going to explain it in a slightly different language, in a more computer scientist language, but it's equivalent to the standard Bell test. But at least I hope that you'll be convinced of that. And it's a game.
So there's a verifier, and well, there are two parties. We can call them provers or Alice and Bob. And the verifier sends
one bit to each of Alice and Bob, and they both return one bit. And there's no communication allowed between Alice and Bob once the game starts. And things
could be set up so that the sort of the events involving Alice and Bob are safe, like separated, so we can enforce the no communication by no superluminal signaling.
And for this particular game, the bits S and T are just chosen randomly, and then Alice and Bob, they return these two bits, and they win the game if this condition is satisfied.
So in succinct form, if the exclusive OR between A and B, which is just the sum modulo 2, is the logical AND of the S and T. And this is a succinct way of writing down this table, but there are four cases of inputs, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And in the first three cases, the parity of these two bits should be 0, So it should be even parity, and in the fourth case, it should be odd parity. And so this is Klauser-Horn,
Simony, and Holtz formulation of Bell's scenario. And if you just sort of, one contemplates this game, you might say, well, is there a strategy where they can always win?
And
well, it turns out there isn't. And then you can ask, well, what's the best, how well can they do? I mean, if they just send random bits, then they'll win with probability 50%. But can they do better than that? And if we consider classical strategies, then the best success probability is 3/4 for this game. And that's actually very
simple to prove, because the success conditions. If it's a classical strategy, then there's no loss of generality if Alice and Bob behave deterministically. Because if they use a randomized strategy where they switch bits, then that's basically tantamount to picking a deterministic strategy according to some probability distribution. So using this deterministic strategy with probability P1, another one with probability P2, etc. And then the performance of that will just be the average of the performances of those deterministic strategies. So they might as well just use the best deterministic strategy, because the average can't be better than the extremal. And if they use a deterministic strategy, then that means that Alice's response is just a function of her question. So A is a function of S. So she has an A0 and an A1. Her answer when the question is 0 and when the question is 1. Similarly for Bob. So any deterministic strategy is summarized by 4 bits,
A0, A1,
B0, and B1. And the success conditions for the 4 cases are given by these equations, modulo 2, and you can't simultaneously satisfy them all. Because if you sum the left side, then every variable appears twice, so you get 0, and if you sum the right side, you get 1. So you can satisfy any 3, but not all 4.
And that's why the success probability is at most 3/4. Now, in case this doesn't look familiar, this is equivalent to
this other formulation where if we define, if we use, instead of 0 and 1 for bits, if we use plus 1 and minus 1, and this is the fact that this expression here, there's no way you can set these variables so that their sum is 4, and I've sort of divided by 4, so we're taking an average, which means that their average can't be more than a half. So each individual term in the sum can be 1, but yet you can't make it so that if you sum them all up, you get 4. And
the reason why I think Bell proposed this kind of scenario is to address the question of, well, what if the world isn't really quantum mechanical? What if there are some other underlying laws of physics that we just haven't discovered yet, which are classical? And if the appearance of these sort of if this randomness when you perform measurements is just an artifact of our ignorance of these sort of extra laws of physics that we're not aware of, and you can rule that possibility out, assuming some notion of you can rule it out in assuming some reasonable conditions, and by the fact that if you have a game like this,
then any physical system that would implement it cannot win more than 3/4
of the time, and yet it's possible to construct a quantum physical system that actually wins more than 3/4 of the time, that wins about 85% of the time.
So there's this extra factor of root 2 in the
that we call the violation. And the strategy is, well, I won't spend much time on it, but they use entanglement. Alice and Bob, before the game starts, they share a Bell state.
And then if they locally apply rotations to their piece of the Bell state, then they modify the global state to be a superposition of something with even parity kets and odd parity kets, and they can somehow organize their rotations so that you'll always get a cosquared or
sine squared of pi over 8.
And in all 4 cases, you'll get this
success probability. Okay? So you can sort of violate the 3/4 bound if you allow quantum entanglement to enter the picture. And And when I first became aware of this, I'm a computer scientist, and when I started working in the field, which was around the time when Shor's algorithm appeared, I thought, well, hey, this is really neat. Maybe we can do better than 85%. You know, maybe it is, because we've only used one e-bit
here. Maybe if we have more entanglement and we do something more sophisticated, maybe we could
they could win all the time. And it was pointed out to me that in fact you can't improve the success probability no matter how much entanglement is available. And this was shown by Cyrilson in 1980 that actually that
0.85 is the best possible.
Any quantum strategy has to meet that bound. Okay. So this is a game that's sort of designed to sort of highlight differences between quantum entangled systems and systems without entanglement. And it's sort of part of a more general class of games, which we can call non-locality games, where just in general, there's
a verifier who sends questions to two parties. They need not be bits. They can range from a larger set. And the questions are determined from some a priori probability distribution that's publicly known. It doesn't have to be uniform. And then there are answers received, which need not be binary. And then the verifier basically looks at the answers and the questions, and there's some function of that determines whether the verifier will accept or not.
So there are the chain Bell inequalities that fit this framework. I could take some points here, yeah. So this is just summarizing what I said. There are games that are based on distributed versions of the Kochan-Specker theorem and other variants of this original Bell CHFH type game.
And for a particular game like this, we're using sort of notation from game theory. We'll let omega sub c denote the classical value of the game, the maximum acceptance probability over any classical strategy of Alice and Bob, where there's no entanglement. So for CHSH, the classical value is 3/4.
It can't be exceeded, and it can be attained. And then we'll define the quantum value of the game.
It will be a scenario where Alice and Bob, well, they have these extra bits, these qubits that are stored in these boxes. And they're entangled with each other, and they can have some arbitrary entangled state. It doesn't have to be ECR pairs, it can be anything.
And the quantum value of the game is the
maximum success probability over all quantum strategies. And in fact, we could even say it's the supremum in case
there's questions as to whether there's some sequence of strategies that approaches some limit. I'll get into that. So there's the quantum value of the game, and an upper bound on the classical value is a Bell inequality. So I'm just rephrasing what many of us already know in this language. And a quantum strategy with a better success probability than the classical value is a Bell inequality violation. Okay, so the 85% CHSH. And an upper bound on even what quantum strategies can do we'll call that a Cyrilson inequality. So we have a particular one, and we can talk about a general one. So there are games like this. There's the Greenberger-Hoyne-Beilinger game, where there's actually three players, and the classical value is 75%, and the quantum value is actually 1. And there are actually two-player games that have that attribute, too, where the quantum value actually is 1. But for CHSH, the quantum value is also below 1. Okay. So having sort of set the stage, now I'd like to get to the topic of my talk, which is parallel repetition. And the idea is that we want to play two games, or the same game twice, but possibly two different games. And but the setting will be, rather than the verifier asking the questions for the first game and then receiving the answers, and then asking the questions for the second game and receiving the answers, the verifier is going to try to do it more efficiently and send off the questions, let's say two questions in advance, just together, and then ask for the two answers together. So the two questions are chosen independently
according to the appropriate distributions for the two games.
And then the verifier will accept if both games succeed. Both Alice and Bob win the first game and they win the second game. And there's one obvious strategy for Alice and Bob if they're playing G1 and G2 in parallel, which is to just take the best strategy they can come up with for G1 and use that, and take the best strategy that they can come up with for G2 and use that and combine them. So just independently play the two games. And the question is that the best way to play? Is that always the optimal way, to just play the two games independently, or is there some way to somehow do things contextually so that you can actually do better? So if the answer is yes, then the value of the combined game would just be the product of the values of the individual games, right? So for playing CHSH twice in parallel, it would be 3/4 times 3/4, which would be 9/16. Okay, so it's I don't know what your intuition is about that, what you think the answer is. There are two answers. I don't know, it's supposed to be interactive. Do a show of hands or something. But yeah, you can, there's sort of some, yeah. So actually, either answer is correct, because there's some...
I haven't said what the subscripts of the
omegas are, whether it's classical or quantum. Okay, so the answer is no for classical strategy, as you can guess what's coming. So for the case of CHSH, well, there's the 3/4, and it would be 9/16 if you played them separately. And here's a way you can actually play them together and win with probability
better than 9/16. Actually, 10/16 is the best you can do for this. And I don't expect you to just look at these tables and see it. But I'm not going to sort of drag you through the technical details. But it's a deterministic strategy. So just to see how this a strategy looks like. Alice gets two questions. So the question for the first game and the second game, and then she's supposed to reply with two answers. So this table summarizes a table like this is a strategy for Alice, a deterministic strategy, and then there's another table for Bob. And notice that they're not playing independently, because Alice is sort of being contextual, because for the game two, here's her input 0 and 1, and she's giving different answers depending on what her input was for game one. So her answer for game two, which is the second bit here, depends on the context of what the question was for the first game. And why is it conceivable? So there might be, one first guess might be, and actually, this is a good chance to, I'll explain in right after this, the next slide, how computer scientists made a mistake on this matter. But intuitively, it should just be the product. The thing is,
for the first game, they can't do, there's no way they can do better than 3/4. Like, of all the questions, if you take all the questions, at most 3/4 of them, they'll be satisfying the first game. And at most 3/4 of them, they'll be satisfying the second game. So you have these two sets. But the point is, if they lose one game or both games, it's the same. Because they only win if they win both games. So it's not any worse to win both games versus one game. So you have these two sets whose size you can't make smaller. They're sort of 3/4. But you can increase the intersection. Sort of make it so that the failures are more concentrated on both games, and then the union will be smaller, and the union is where they lose both games. And this actually was, I raised this question in a seminar in Waterloo, and Scott Aronson pointed this out to me, and he did actually computer search, and then he found that this
this is quite recent. And that actually Barrett, Collins, Hardy, Kent, and Popescu had actually addressed this exact question in a paper in 2002.
This is just the intuition that I just explained. Okay, so the answer is no for classical strategies. And it's not easy to compare them. We've analyzed it for three games, too, or actually Scott has. But for four games, we're not quite sure, and you know, what happens if you, and for other games, we don't have a nice way of combining them. because you can't just analyze the game separately. It gets more complicated as you have more games. And the so now I'd like to say that the same issue arose in this area of computer science that in the 1980s, when most computer scientists were not thinking very, maybe Gilles Bassard was the exception, very much about quantum information. And there was in the context of multi-prover interactive proof systems, it was sort of asserted that if you have an interactive proof system and the failure probability is epsilon and it's not small enough, well, just run the system again. And the chances that the provers will somehow trick you into believing something is true that isn't twice, if they can win, do it once, and with probability epsilon, then if you run the game twice, then the probability of doing that would just be epsilon squared, etc. And that was used as a component in another paper, and it's in the theory of probabilistic decoupled proofs, if that means anything to you. And then the error was discovered actually by one of the authors
of the earlier paper that that's actually not true. So
sort of like the example I pointed out before,
but it was for a different game, not CHSH. And that was actually a game where it was even more dramatic, because the probability of playing the game, winning the game once, was two-thirds.
It is two-thirds.
And if you play twice, it's still two-thirds. It doesn't even go down at all. But if you play it three times for that particular game, then it does go down.
So the question was, what happens? Like, can you at least say that it eventually approaches zero if you keep playing the game many times? And this remained an open question. And there were some incremental results, and then there was this what's considered a few years later in 95, Ron Raz showed what's sort of somewhat celebrated results, a parallel repetition theorem,
which is that even though you can't multiply the probabilities, there's something that's in some sense morally equivalent, and that's good enough for purposes,
and certainly in
computational complexity, which is that if you have a game whose value is less than one. First of all, if the value of the game is one, well, there's no point in repeating because they'll just win every time. But if they can't win with probability one, if the probability is alpha, then if you play the game n times, well, although the probability of winning all n times is not alpha to the n, there exists some other constant less than one, beta, which in general will be larger than alpha, but still less than one, and such that the probability of winning n times is order beta to the n. So not only does it approach zero, but it approaches zero exponentially with the number of repetitions. So even qualitatively, it's even quantitatively, there's some use to this. And really, the question that's underlying this is: Is there a similar parallel repetition theorem for
quantum?
The quantum case. If they have entanglement and you play the game many times, like for CHSH,
well. It's 85% for playing it once. What happens if you play it more times? Does it even approach zero as you play it more and more times? And for general, I say it's an open question. So for general games, I don't know the answer. I mean, I'd like to know, but it's open. And the techniques in Raz's theorem,
I mean, very much it's you know, if we think about
this as being similar to non-locality, he's using local hidden variables everywhere. I mean, that's okay. So what I can do is say, or what we can do is say something about parity games or XOR games, which is an XOR symbol. So what's an XOR game? An XOR game is a non-locality game that has some restrictions.
So the answers that Alice and Bob provide are just single bits. And the verifier's decision about whether to accept or not, it doesn't depend
on the individual bits
A and B, but just on whether their parity is even or odd. So in other words, there's some function you can come up with such that success is equivalent to the parity of A and B being that function of
S and T,
where A and B are the answers and
S and T are the questions. So CHSH is an XOR game. The change Bell inequalities is an XOR game. There's this odd cycle game that's an XOR game. So many games are XOR games, and there are some interesting ones. Now, XOR games, getting back to multi-prover interactive proof systems, if you restrict yourself in that context to XOR games, then you have exactly the same expressive power
as for general games. So from
the point of view of the
multi-prover interactive proof systems, this restriction doesn't really... You don't lose anything by imposing this restriction.
But it's different if we consider the quantum version of these games, because then it
apparently becomes weaker. Instead of being complete for non-deterministic exponential time, it's in exponential time.
That doesn't mean much to you, then don't worry about it. But it seems that there's for XOR games, entanglement does seem to allow the players to cheat. They can do some kind of Bell inequality violation to somehow trick the verifier. Or there's no strategy of the verifier that somehow what one would like to do is come up with a strategy of the verifier that somehow defangs quantum information, that uses some error correcting code or some redundancy or some property of entanglement, such that entanglement won't help Alice and Bob, so that any protocol that's good without taking into account entanglement will be fine with entanglement if you do this extra work to sort of defang the entanglement. And I don't know how to do that for general for these general non-locality games, and for these XOR games it's known that you can't
because they're weaker.
Actually
they're weaker. Well, we get into this issue in computational complexity theory. It's not really known whether X for next or equal or not. It's like T versus NT. But most people believe that they're not. So
I've got apparently weaker.
Sorry, can you tell me what apparently weaker expressive power means?
Okay, so there's a set of languages that are next, and then there's a subset of that which are X. X means exponential time, next means non-deterministic. And it's not really known whether X is a proper subset of next, but it seems to be, in the, for all we know, because it's there's no it's analogous to P versus NP. So there are these problems in NP that seem to take exponential time, for all we know, and most people would maybe hedge their place their bets on NP problems in general requiring exponential time. But it's not known. It may be that someone next week will publish a paper saying P equals NP. So apparently it means, in computational complexity, one has to sort of qualify these things. You can use better words. Apparently it's a bit vague. But so if, let me put it another way. If X is not equal to next,
then it's weaker
for sure. So either you get a collapse or you get a separation.
Okay. And, well, the good news is, well, the answer is yes for XOR games. So maybe you're wondering, well, what was the question again?
And the question was...
So for XOR games, yeah. For XOR games, like CXSH is an XOR game. And if you play the XOR games in parallel, you can't just multiply the success probability. You can't just analyze the games independently. If you're playing classically. So that example I gave you, that table you mentioned Scott Harrington gave me, that's for the best classical strategy for CHSH. But the best quantum strategy for CHSH that achieves 85%, if you're playing it twice, the best strategy is just to play each one individually with 85% probability. There's no way you can somehow do things contextually to do better than that. So this is the theorem, that if you have a bunch of
XOR games, and I'd like to remove this restriction, but improve something. But at least when you have XOR games, then if you want to win them all, then the best strategy for doing that is to just the product of the individual strategy. So you just individually analyze the games and you don't take into account contextuality.
And it also means we
can evaluate the value of these games very easily because we can
individually evaluate the games. I'd like to, this is the structure of the proof, which I'm going to go through, just to highlight some of the features.
I don't want to, I just want to discuss some of the highlights of the proof. So the proof uses this vector system characterization of the XOR games, which I'll mention shortly. And that basically fits in the framework of semi-definite programming in a nice way.
And that sort of makes these games nice to work with. And
then using this characterization, we can analyze not playing the conjunction of these XOR games, but playing something else, which we call the XOR of XOR games, which is where you kind of want to win an even number of games, in a sense. I'll explain that, but we get a nice expression for the XOR of XOR games. And then we can somehow relate these expressions for XORs of XOR games to the actual quantity that we're interested in bounding, which is this. So we know that it's at least this. So it's just a question of showing it's no greater than this, because one strategy is to just play all the games independently, which will achieve this value. The question is just whether you can do better, and that's what we're proving that you can't.
Okay, so for the first step, this is worth mentioning that actually this is another observation of Cyrilson, that
for XOR games, you can always characterize them in a very nice geometric way.
You can come up with vectors.
So for each question, there's a unit vector in some real space for Alice and for Bob, such that for every protocol, the probability that the parity is zero is the bias of that probability away from a half is the inner product of the vectors. So maybe if I just go through this happens to be the optimal vector system for the CHSH game, and let me go through it. So the actual best bias is when this is 1 over root 2. That's when you get 85%. And look at these vectors. The inner product between x0 and y0 is 1 over root 2. Between x0 and y1 is 1 over root 2. y0 and x1 is 1 over root 2. And in the other case, the 1-1 case, here the inner product is minus 1 over root 2. So this sort of corresponds to the optimal strategy.
Now, in general, for XOR games,
the vectors might be in a larger dimensional space.
It's somehow finding the optimal set of
vectors when you have some linear combination of expressions like of this form, which are the probabilities weighting these biases,
it's a semi-definite programming problem, and it can be solved efficiently. And you can also sort of prove things about these things when they're in that framework. So now I'd like to discuss the second step of the proof, which pertains to taking the XOR of XOR games.
And to define the
XOR of XOR games,
if you're just playing one game, you want the parity of A and B to be this function of the inputs to the first game. And for the second game, you'd want it to be this. And suppose that you just want the sum. Alice and Bob just output one bit each, such that the XOR is the sum mod 2 of these quantities for the two games.
So in other words, if they...
I'll say more about it later. But this is
in itself another XOR game. And maybe if I can explain this a little more by just explaining what's maybe the obvious strategy for playing this game. So if you had an XOR of XOR game, then the obvious strategy would be to
just take the best strategy you know for the first game that would yield an A1 and a B1 for Alice and Bob, and the best strategy for the second game. And if these are both right, like if this equals this and this equals this, then their XOR will equal this XOR, and they'll win. And they'll also win if they're both wrong. But the more likely, the higher the probability that these equalities occur, the more likely it is that their XOR will be correct. And then Alice has A1 and A2, and she outputs the parity of A1 and A2, and Bob outputs the parity of B1 and B2. And then if you take the parity of A and B, that's just the parity of all these things, which is supposed to be this.
Kind of a rough sketch. If you had more time to contemplate it, this would be the obvious way to play. And if you analyze the strategy, the nice way to analyze it is in terms of
the bias. So if the probability of winning game one is 1 plus epsilon 1 over 2, and game 2 is 1 plus epsilon 2 over 2, then the success probability of this way of playing the parity of the two games, the bias will be the product of the two biases.
That's the first game. And now we can ask a similar question. Instead of winning both games, if we want to win the parity of two games, is sort of the obvious strategy optimal? And I could, well, I'm going to run out of time, so I won't belabor the point. But again, classically, the answer is actually no.
That there's a better way, sort of, to play these games contextually. And actually playing the XOR of CHSH with itself is just as easy as playing CHSH. So if you're playing CHSH, XOR CHSH, then entanglement doesn't help. You still win with 3/4 probability.
And these games, let me go back. There's a point I forgot to mention.
I said classically no.
But in the quantum case, the answer is actually yes.
You just multiply. You just play the two games individually, and then you take the XORs of the outcomes in the way that I described further.
And why? Well, you take the vector system for the first game and the vector system for the second game, and then for the XOR of the two games, you take the tensor product of the two vectors, which is almost the outcome. And then by using the theory of semi-definite programming, it can be shown, you have to massage things a little bit to make it work, but you can show that basically works. And then we can find a relationship between, so we understand now the XORs of the XOR game, and now we go back to the original question, which is the conjunction of these XOR games. And we can somehow express the values of conjunctions, so we can bound them in terms of the values of XORs. So let's suppose
we have n XOR games, and each of them has bias, the kth game has bias epsilon k. Then we can actually come up with many XORs. We can take the XOR of all of these, or we could just take the subscript should be a 2 here. We could just take the XOR of the first two or some other subset. And in fact, for any subset of the indices, 1 to n, you can just take the XOR of that subset of games.
And that's an XOR game. And we know how to analyze that XOR game, because of what I said before. Because of this additivity
property, maybe you think it should be called multiplicativity
or multiple. But
anyway, because of this property that I called additivity, you just multiply the biases.
Look at it in a different way. Additivity is a reasonable word. So you can perfectly analyze those. And then it turns out that the relationship between the conjunctions and these
G sub M means just the parity of all the games
associated with the subset M is
bounded by this. It's actually using a bit of classical Fourier analysis to show this. You get some. This is actually going to be a collapsing sum. So this is sort of the average of all the biases, of all these XORs of all the subsets, and that's an upper bound on
the value of the conjunction of the game. And then
if you take the average of the biases, well, that's just this expression here. If you just multiply these all out, you just get
all the products, and that's exactly the product of the values of the individual games. So that's what we wanted to prove. This upper bound. Okay. So the conclusion of this is, well, parallel repetition of these Cyrilson type bounds, it works very nicely. If you have XOR games, well, at least for XOR games, then they're multiplicative in a very strong sense. You can just multiply the probabilities. It's not like Raz's theorem where you have to come up with, where it's not, you can't multiply the probabilities, but you get something that's almost as good. So I guess this is an open question.
And maybe the open question pertaining to this talk, if you have if you don't consider games which are not XOR games, then all bets are off. In fact, John Watrous has an example of a game that's
not an XOR game where if you play it twice, the success probability is the same as playing it once. But if you play it many times, then for that particular game, it seems like the success probability gets smaller, but we haven't really analyzed it. But the question is, in general,
if you have a game In the context of quantum information, if you have some game with some success probability
alpha
less than one of winning it once, then if you play it many times,
how does the probability of winning them all go? Does it even approach zero? And does it approach zero exponentially fast? Is there a counterpart to Raz's parallel repetition theorem? And getting back to multi-prover interactive proof systems, there's this other
burning question, which me and other people have been thinking about for a number of years, is when you have a multi-prover interactive proof system, and the two provers,
if they're allowed to share entanglement, which seems quite reasonable,
then what is the expressive power?
In the classical case, which is the case when these models were first studied, so it wasn't even conceivable in the mindset of many computer scientists that there was this thing called entanglement that could somehow enter the picture.
But if they have entanglement, then what is the expressive power? If they don't, it's next. And if they do, well, we don't even know whether it's less than next or more than next, because there's a completeness probability and a soundness probability.
There are cases where something is actually true and you want the proof to succeed. And when something is false, and then you want a situation where no matter what the provers do, it won't succeed. And it sort of cuts both ways, because entanglement can make the success probability in both cases change. So perhaps it's the same, it's next, but it could be less, it could be more. And I don't know the answer. That's where I'll stop.
Thank you.